Hello, everybody. Welcome to another set of podcast on Policy Talk. Today, we have Professor Sachin Chaturvedi, who is the Director General of RIS, which is the Research and Information System for Developing Countries. He's a well-known trade economist, and RIS, as you know, is one of the best think tanks on trade and innovation under the Ministry of External Affairs. He has recently been given an honorary post of Vice Chairperson of Atal Bihari Vajpayee Institute of Good Governance and Policy Analysis, which is a state-level policy analysis, oblique-making institution in Madhya Pradesh, one of the few similar to Niti Aayog at the union government level. He also is on the board of RBI and has recently authored a report on differentiated licenses and the entry of private sector in banking. So welcome to the show, Professor Chaturvedi. Good to have you with us.
Thank you and good morning to you.
I wanted to begin with your report on private sector banking and specifically if you could talk a little bit about differentiated banking licenses in that report.
Thanks a lot. I think, Yatish, probably it would be good to have a sort of historical perspective as to how things have evolved when we talk about banking and differentiated sort of options that that we have.
Yeah.
And right from 1947 onwards, if you look at the scenario, back in 47, we had around 97 scheduled private banks.
Yeah.
97 scheduled private banks. And we had around 557 non-scheduled private banks and somewhere close to 395 cooperative banks. So you can imagine the dense structure that we have. And at that point, the bandwidth was so huge that the commercial banks that were there, they were largely, of course, linked with business houses. But they were also trying to bring in the bandwidth that was needed for the expansion. And when in 1969, when we went for commercialization, the number actually came down to 14 major commercial banks.
Yep.
And then six were more added in 1980. So with that, we have entered in a scenario which only after Nasiman Committee was constituted in 91. Yes. That you got the bandwidth. And this bandwidth then came in 93 when the idea of creating the private sector entities came in, and then you got ICICI and others who actually started playing the role, and the local area banks then were identified. The report that we have given the expert working group, it was largely sort of trying to suggest as to how the 2004 guidelines and 2005 guidelines on ownership and governance in private sector banks, how they should be streamlined. Because in 2011, another set of guidelines came in. 2013, some more guidelines came in. So as a result, it all became quite confusing in terms of how this is to be done. So 2013-14, RBI issued a discussion paper. And that's where Mr. Rajawat, this whole issue of small finance bank and payment banks came in. Yeah. And we started looking into these dimensions with greater clarity. And small finance bank, cooperative banks, the voluntary transition of primary urban cooperative banks into that small finance bank. That whole issue came up and we started looking into some of these dimensions which were of great significance. And if you look at external sector, particularly countries like US, etc., which are big democracies and have huge market and extent of ownership that are needed. So the IWG report, if you look at on RBI website, you would see that we have tried to create this distinction of how you can have the capital infusion from the private sector without them actually deciding about the way money would be actually governed. So how the arm's length governance of banks without getting sort of a private sector to play that role of influencing what you saw in case of Yes Bank and others, how we can avoid repeat of those instances.
You know, I just wanted to interrupt you there. You know, it's somehow, you know, banking is now the only sector which is licensed, heavily controlled, heavily regulated. And we're still struggling with this ownership. I mean, I thought we had bypass this ownership issues of private sector versus public sector. You know, I mean, by now we should have accepted that there's a lot of good in private sector, and the role of the government or the regulator has to make the rules. You know, a Yes Bank will happen, like an Enron will happen. So these are exceptional situations. You cannot prevent the private sector from entering into a sector because you feel that there will be a misuse or some form of fraud taking place. By that count, you know, you would not have private sector in any sector whatsoever. So, I mean, you know, fundamentally, and this brings to me to the question that, you know, we have still not addressed the elephant in the room. In that sense, we've still not addressed the issue of digital banking. While we have touched it a little bit with the payment banks, who have not done so very well because they have been, you know, burdened with these small loans and small deposits. We reach a stage where we'll address the elephant in the room, which is digital banking.
Absolutely right, Mr. Rajawat. I think two or three issues are important here. Digital, of course, is extremely important in this setting. But it is also not so much about ownership. So it is not so much about public or private ownership.
Absolutely.
It is about the issue of governance. And digital, from that point of view, becomes very important because then you have the technological bandwidth to get into regulation. And you would be glad to know now more and more sort of reliance on technology is emerging.
Yes.
Being on the RBI board, I'm also chairing IT committee of the board, the subcommittee on information technology. So with the RABBIT and with the IDRBT, IFTAS, we are trying to see how these institutions can play a far greater important role in terms of the digital platforms being created for enhancing effectiveness of governance. How real-time data is analyzed, absorbed, and as you might have seen during a COVID-19 crisis, the RTGS and many other services were on for absolutely right. They served us as a huge support in terms of expanding the bandwidth and expanding the gravitas of our interactions. So much so that the RBI right now is chairing the SAR group in our own neighborhood. And RBI has created a network for a financial sync with all the SAR countries, including with Pakistan. So this is hardly known outside in public circles, but we are seeing that the bandwidth is leveraged by our partner countries for collective development, the currency swap arrangements that have come in. So you are absolutely right. Digital banking would play an extremely important role, and growing reliance by Reserve Bank of India on this is going to provide not only greater scrutiny, reliance, and scope for better governance, but would also pave way for our wider global linkages.
Do we see a digital banking license coming forward then?
As you would appreciate, since I have some additional responsibility in the eastern area of the Reserve Bank, because I come on the board from the eastern area. So from eastern area, particularly northeastern area, where we have very few brick and mortar branches.
Yes.
And we have more of the business correspondence and reliance on them. The idea of Prime Minister to have optical fiber networks across villages is bringing in a greater revolution, Rajawat, when it comes to our reliance on technology and providing banking services through the business correspondence, BCs as they are called.
Yeah.
And these BCs have now become a major instrument in these areas. And so is the fact, as I saw in Madhya Pradesh, in Badwani and in Dhar districts, where bank outreach is limited, the BCs are providing the technology solutions that are needed for deposit and also for withdrawals. And this, I think, is important. So digitalization has helped. That's the way forward.
And digitizations of banks and digitization of banking services to digital banking licenses. Why I'm drawing that difference is because of the fact that digital bank licenses by its very nature will be branchless banking. And all our banking regulations have traditionally been based on branches. As in, you know, we say that you are allowed to open a branch or you're not allowed to open a branch here, or you're supposed to open more branches in rural areas, et cetera, et cetera. So the core of branching regulation, as we see, has been branches based in that sense. So While in digital banking licenses, if a bank were to go completely digital, it won't have any branches except one, maybe one large centralized headquarter. So how will this anomaly be handled from a regulatory point of view?
Mr. Rajabhat, you would have to appreciate the fact that the heterogeneity in development across the country is extremely profound. Yes. The challenges are not common. What you see in Mumbai, Delhi, and other metros, they're very different from what you see on the ground in mofussil areas, be that in states like Madhya Pradesh or even the Northeast that I mentioned to you.
Yes.
So we are having a huge development challenge. Priority sector lending is extremely important. And from that point of view, the bank branches would have to be present in the areas where they can do the heavy lifting for development deficits that we see.
You just mentioned business correspondent. Now, business correspondent work extremely well with digital banks, you know. Most rural branches, as you know, are loss-making. So banks themselves are not keen on opening it, but they're keen on giving business correspondents a right to, you know, expand their services. So in a sense, it's not a, you know, it's not an either-or situation. It is a situation where, you know, you would actually facilitate better banking, for instance, in Northeast, if you had digital banks and business correspondents to roll out services there. The cost of service would be lower. The cost of servicing will be lower. The cost of lending would be lower because, you know, you're taking establishment costs are the second highest cost in a bank, as you know, rentals, salaries, branch, electricity, all that thing, you know, all that thing goes away. So, you know, it's quicker to roll out.
That is true. We are also having the challenge of them being grounded in the areas where they actually really want to focus on, because that's where the governance part comes in. The footloose soldiers, you are never sure how the governance part would come in. And then if everybody is trying to just focus on few niche areas where margins are high, cost of transactions are low, then you really do not know how best we can, because that would be tendency of all, as you know, even in the optical fiber networks and spectra net, et cetera, when they came in, the TRAI also had a similar question in terms of the bandwidth. So you need to see how the whole country is covered and not covered by one or two or scheduled commercial banks alone, but by everybody, including those which are getting into digitalization. We are having a huge struggle with several foreign banks. We are continuously seeing that for last 4 years, the Reserve Bank is continuously telling them for data localization. And despite reminders, guidelines, and timelines, they are trying to, and only after MasterCard failed continuously that RBI had to come out with the directive that they did. Yes. So that way, Mr. Rajabhat, it is becoming a bit of an issue in terms of how actors, particularly private sector, and that also foreign branches of the banks and other entities like credit cards, etc., what kind of heavy lifting they are prepared to do. And this, we should not forget that our banks, when they are given licenses, they also have to do this, whether they are based in Singapore or in New York or any other part. So you have these guidelines by central banks or FedEx, etc., where they have to follow this. So I think it is important. But I see your point in terms of reducing the establishment costs by the banks.
Let me take you to another issue now. Now that you are part of the Atal Bihari Vajpayee Institute of Good Governance and Policy Analysis, you know, from your perk at RIS and working with the central government for years, and especially on national trade, now you move to understanding also a little bit of what happens at a district level and a state government level. And I think that is very crucial for a policymaker or an expert like you. What is your learning? I know it's been a few months, but what is your learning of the last few months as to the difference in what happens on the ground and what is thought about by policymakers at a Delhi level? You know, what is the way of the gap?
Excellent question. Thanks, Mr. Rajabhat. It's just I have completed 2 months, So just yesterday, so just 2 months are over. But I have already traveled across some 7 districts of Madhya Pradesh and have met district level, block level, and some Jilla Parishad members. I see this as a huge deficit. Fortunately or unfortunately, I have been focusing on international trade for last 30 years and based in Delhi and couple of foreign universities where I was based. I have been trying to see a very macro picture at the global level and seeing India's international trade participation from WTO and other perspectives. Little aware of how the production part actually gets linked with our export sector. Madhya Pradesh is one of the landlocked states. Yes. As I had an opportunity to study Bhutan and Nepal and some of the Central Asian republics. So I see that all of them have their trade agencies because trade aspirations are there even among landlocked countries. Yes. In Madhya Pradesh, I was surprised to see they still need institutional frameworks to promote exports. And though they are landlocked, but they are at the heart of the country. They are all the containers, all the
it's a logistical hub.
They have to move through the logistics. So you would be glad to know. And the first thing that I have discussed with the Chief Minister, and they have agreed, is to have a logistics policy announced soon. And fortunately, with Asian Development Bank, we could connect to have an app that can quickly clear the cargo or consignments that are passing through the state. So without interruption of any kind, without any disruption, that the travel is to be ensured, a seamless flow of trade. And that also brings in the intra-district trade that is of significance. So first and foremost, what I'm realizing is the reality at the ground, and they, if I look at from the development perspective, which has also been of forte in terms of, I give you an example of sustainable development goals, for instance.
Yes.
So how SDG we look at national level where India is lagging behind, and how at state level they need to capture. So the idea of the sustainable development goals, the targets, and the indicators. And the indicators for the 17 goals are somewhere close to 169 indicators.
Yeah.
So how departmental-wise interwoven targets that you look at and the interdependent indicators that you look at, they bring in many departments in one go. So if water, like goal 6 is there, the goal 6 is crucially dependent on sanitation, it is dependent on water supply, and it is also dependent on water bodies that you are creating. So all
multiple
in one
departments and multiple ministries at the state level, and not all of them aligned on the same goals. You know, the irrigation
exactly.
department would be aligned on some other goal, the sanitation is on another goal, and I don't think so they would be aligned on an SDG goal, you know, in that sense. So I understand the challenge that you're now observing.
So what fortunately Madhya Pradesh government has done is that apart from bringing AIGGPA, the Atal Bihari Vajpayee Institute of Good Governance, they have also established a State Niti Evam Yojana Ayog. State Niti Evam Yojana Ayog is also what I am vice chairman of. So these two institutions have been combined. So as vice chairman of Niti Ayog of Madhya Pradesh, I am also able to, and they have given the status of the cabinet minister. So that way, I am able to convene other department principal secretaries as well on one platform. So like logistics policy, I could chair the group because of the status that the chief minister has given, and also the ability to convene all the departments together on one platform. So research is one, but action is also coming in here because of this additional position. And that's where, Mr. Rajawat, I think we have to see at the ground as to how we do away with the departmental distinctions, because convergence is the way forward. And that way, some states are doing fantastic work. As I see, Odisha has, in 2019, launched a new program called convergence, because that convergence is happening at the level of beneficiaries. And Odisha's this effort is trying to connect all departments at the level of beneficiary. So a beneficiary need not run to different departments, but all departments are being convened through the convergence scheme, and that is largely targeted on tribals, the huge tribal population that Orissa has. And this convergence is now delivering what is desired to be delivered at that grassroots level. I think we have some way to learn from each other and see how at the citizens' level all these programs converge.
Interesting, because I recently I was having a conversation with one of the aspirational districts district commissioner. Now he was telling me something very interesting. He's saying that the government is trying to combine elements of MGNREGA's labor component with a lot of other schemes like the Jal Shakti Mission or the irrigation department schemes or even the urban housing, the affordable housing schemes. But while it is, the plans are made great in terms of combination at the union government at Delhi level, at the state and district level, there is hardly any capacity to conceptualize a project of affordable housing. Like, for instance, basically, MGNREGA envisaged conceptualization by a sarpanch and the district panchayat office and the district commissioner. They don't have expertise of conceptualizing an affordable housing project along with MGNREGA. So the scheme is not failed because of intention. It is failed because of capacity of conceptualizing a project. And this we have seen successively over the years. Schemes don't fail because of intention. Intentions are always good. But good intention does not result in good implementations. Now with this perk, is there a certain goal or a target that you have in mind that you want to kind of achieve over the next 3-4 years while you're there in terms of better implementation of schemes?
Definitely, you have really pointed out the most important and very crucial point in this whole idea of outreach, particularly from development perspective. I would give you just one example to illustrate the point that I'm trying to make. And this is something that the Chief Minister of Madhya Pradesh launched 2 weeks back, a new scheme called Devaranya. And this Devaranya is a scheme which is trying to address requirements of a tribal population. Madhya Pradesh has something like 21% of tribal population in the state. So five tribal districts have been chosen. And the idea is that under Community Forest Right Act, which was actually passed in 2006 and has not been implemented so far because Forest Department doesn't want any community participation to come in. Not that they don't want, but the structure is such that it hasn't taken off. And there are several states which have done that. So last month, actually, Ministry of Environment and Forest in Delhi and for tribal affairs, they came out with joint guidelines to operationalize under PESA, the Community Forest Right Act. And this has paved way for the two to work together. So under Devaranya, what has been identified is that the Gram Sabha would identify a small set of residents of tribal population, a group of 10 under SHG. And this SHG would grow their own medicinal and aromatic plant being supplied by the NMPB, the National Medicinal Aromatic Plant Board of Ayush Ministry. And this plantation would be funded by MGNREGA. Okay. And they would be herbs or shrubs, so they would have the value for 1 or 2 years to be fully realized. And then under the MP-led program and under Ayush Ministry's project, they would be given some machinery for primary value addition. And then five companies have been linked with this scheme to have the buyback arrangement. Okay. So state is not intervening anyway, no minimum support, etc. State is out, but state is playing the catalytic role, the facilitating role. And this is where the success of future welfare programs would come from. You have to connect the market, you have to allow a market, but you have to bring in the governance mechanisms for market to abide by the rules and regulations.
Absolutely.
And this is an example which I wanted to mention in response to your point that schemes are well-intentioned, but implementation is bad. So we are doing away with implementation and we are also doing away with the role of the state in terms of governing it. Let people and the market connect. they connect in the most optimum level is the role that state has to play, so that there is no exploitation kind of perspective, nor any kind of disruption. So you facilitate, but facilitate in a manner that both parties do the role that they are expected to do. Tomorrow, it should not happen that the private sector says that the planting material, the quality material is not there. So you supply quality material, get it vetted by the private company, and then encourage the tribals to grow. So if good material is there, they will grow the good material. So this is how this Devaranya is going to set in new examples of governance that I think are going to be the way forward.
It would be good to see the success of that this scheme. I was reading about some of the reports of AIGGPA, and one of the interesting report I saw there, and this is the first time I've seen a state-level report, was on agri-solution centers. And it was quite firm and quite clear about the reason for its failures, including the fact that, a pilot ASC was not set up. The ones that were set up were not set up in a proper manner. Just the fact that too much was tried to be done in a public or a government setup than could be even done, profitably in a private setup. They just tried to do too many things, So any policy which has too many objectives is almost primed for failure in that sense, because, you can never meet all the objectives. What is your observation of the learning that the state has taken from your report on ASC? Are they doing something about it? Are you suggesting something new in some terms of collaboration with private sector, like in Devaranya?
I see. In Devaranya, what we have tried to do is to see how multiple targeted interventions actually bring in the optimum results that you are looking at. So for any new intervention, particularly the program such as ASC, which involve sort of multiple services and stakeholders, pilot projects approach, they would help us in implementing and also would support the implementing agencies in identifying the field level challenges in execution of the program, which in turn may provide inputs for policymakers in doing course correction in the scheme design before it is launched. So it is important that those schemes are preconceived in terms of possible challenges and disruptions, because coherence and coordination are crux for this. If multiple interventions are targeted or multiple stakeholders are coming in, and that I think would help build some sort of a confidence among the farmers, because the effectiveness of technology is coming in, that transfer would bring in, but also some sort of training is required of the people. So suddenly, if you bring in something as happened in case of ASC, the acceptance by the farmers, the role that the extension agencies have to play is not going to go forward. Like, for instance, in Barwani district, I visited a private company which is doing tissue culture. So that is far more effective than the ASC scheme, because the private sector has got some 500 women, tribal women, and they all are class 3 or class 4 failed. And they have been trained for tissue culture, and they are doing mass multiplication of banana and bamboo tissue culture. Wow. And you would be surprised to know banana is the most profitable production in Barwani. And exported from Madhya Pradesh via Maharashtra. So all the value addition happens in Maharashtra if it is processed. Otherwise, even raw bananas are being exported. So you are seeing the potential, you are seeing the growth actually happening. But the agri solutions, if not adequately processed at the systemic level, then it is not likely to go forward as one may bring in. So I think those theoretical insights, which maybe some business school might be talking about, I think are important for us to see how do we take that forward. And then I think a couple of points, Mr. Rajawat, that are I think important is to build knowledge produce, which is likely to have the public policy sort of formulation process more thoroughly linked with the development tools that we have been talking about. Now, the system has changed, the requirements have changed. You can't run the public policy schemes with old tools. you need to change those tools. You have to leverage more of technology and the leadership skills that are needed. You need to bring in a sort of these tools which are more social sector oriented. They have to bring in the evidences, and continuous course correction is required. So evidence-based policy making is not one-shot solution. It has to be at various levels and continuously to be rediscovered and discovered. So I think AIGGPA's report reflects precisely on this continuous evaluation process. And that, I think, is probably the way forward.
That's a good thing to hear, that a person like you is there. And I hope that, AAC, if it is reinvented, in a PPP model. And, the example of the banana culture, this thing, tissue culture experiment that you were talking about, if that is taken as a case study and, reinvented in an AAC structure where the private sector runs the AAC, and the state exactly. only develops the rules and says that, okay, fine, we'll give you the land or we will give you the wherewithal or we'll help you get the capital. But it is run by somebody who makes a business out of it, and then
absolutely right. And if that is what Devarani stands for, the government is giving you the forestry land. Government is giving you the human resources, trained human resources, and they are also giving you the capital investment for primary value addition. And then you are done. You are in touch with a private sector which is going to do the second stage value addition or third stage, because branding, marketing, etc., Dabur and Imami would do far better than any Absolutely. Tribal grouping can ever imagine to do, because they are specialized in that.
Yeah, sometimes the state tries to do too many things that should not be doing, and sometimes policymakers do not realize that at the ground, it's just impossible to do all these things. So it's good to see your fresh thinking, especially on evidence-based and data-based policymaking on it. I would have liked to continue this conversation furthermore, Professor, but I'm coming at an end of my slot for this particular program. I would like to invite you again, maybe after 2-3 months, once you have settled in furthermore with the AIGGPA, and talk a little bit more about that and also about the digital banking license in furthermore detail. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.